Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 7, the 25th of April. So far in our story, we've been focusing on the fortunes of the German Ninth Army, the formation of the Halber Pocket, and the evolving escape plan from that pocket to link up with the 12th Army. But before we dive into today's events relating to our main story, there are a couple of important events which also took place today which, whilst not directly impacting the Ninth Army, are still momentous in their own right. Firstly, on the 25th of April, the Soviets and Americans finally linked up on the Elbe, when the Soviet 5th Guards Army encountered patrols from US 1st Army near Torgau, northeast of Leipzig. This meeting between the Western and Eastern Fronts meant that the once mighty German Reich was now formally split in two. Secondly, Berlin was also formally encircled by Zhukov and Konev's fronts today, when their forces linked up northeast of Potsdam. The dual encirclement of Berlin and the Ninth Army would now lead to the Soviets referring to the Germans still defending the capital as the Berlin Group, whilst the forces of the Ninth Army encircled in the Halber Pocket will be referred to as the Frankfurt-Guben Group by the Soviets. Frankfurt Oder and Guben being two significant towns along the Oder and Neisse rivers, which have now been captured by the Soviets. Moreover, for our story, the 25th of April is also the day on which elements of the Ninth Army launched the first significant breakout attempt from the Halber Pocket. But before we get to that breakout attempt, let's first check in on the progress of Wenck's 12th Army to the west. So today see the 12th Army Theodor Körner Division continuing their attack on Treuenbrietzen, whilst the Scharnhorst Division also started moving towards the vital town of Bielitz. Here, it would advance upon the Bielitz Heilstätten Hospital complex a few kilometres outside of the town. The hospital complex had been pillaged by Soviet troops when they passed through the day before, and for the remaining staff and patients they might have believed this would be the only action they would see. However, on the morning of the 25th, everyone inside the hospital awoke to the thunder of artillery fire which rained down on the complex and which even hit one of the hospital blocks. Children were rushed down to the cellar and the nurses and doctors wondered if the advancing troops could be Americans. In fact, it was the German troops from the 12th Army who immediately engaged the Soviet forces around the hospital complex and pushed them back from the site. Over the next few days, intense battles would rage between the Germans and the Soviets occupying Bielitz, with the commander of the Scharnhorst Division reporting that no Soviet prisoners were taken. Despite the viciousness of the fighting, however, the 12th Army troops performed far beyond what Wenck had initially believed them capable of, as the hitherto inexperienced soldiers showed fantastic acts of bravery and determination when coming up against superior Soviet forces. It's likely that the crucial factor here is that these 12th Army men were fighting to rescue German civilians and to save their comrades in the 9th Army. This was an honourable cause, and it was surely much better to fight and potentially die with honour rather than risk throwing your life away in a pointless attempt to rescue Hitler in Berlin. The hospital complex suffered greatly during the fighting, with 76 dead, of which 15 were children. But despite these losses, on the 28th of April, the 12th Army Ulrich von Hutten Division evacuated the remaining 3,000 sick and wounded hospital patients and transported them towards the town of Barby along the Elbe River, where they were handed over into the care of the Americans as prisoners of war. But whilst the 12th Army was successful in capturing the hospital complex near Bielitz, their attack on Treuenbrietzen stalled. And by 3 p.m. on the 25th of April, they had been driven back to the outskirts of the town by elements of the Soviet 13th Army. Despite the intense fighting, Wenck nevertheless ordered his forward elements around Treuenbrietzen to hold their ground and prepare to receive the 9th Army if they managed to break out of the Halber Pocket. Wenck's progress was being eagerly watched by the defenders of Berlin and by Hitler in his bunker, in the hope that Wenck could somehow reach their beleaguered city and break the Soviet siege. Nazi propaganda was fanning these fires of hope, of course, and leaflets were dropped over Berlin telling the people that Wenck was on his way to save them. Hitler also kept up the pressure on Wenck, issuing further desperate orders to him on the evening of the 25th. These orders demanded that the 12th Army disregard the Soviet attacks on its flanks and instead create attack groups to punch through the Bielitz area and link up with the 9th Army, in order to form that coordinated thrust towards Potsdam and southern Berlin. Hitler was hooked on the dream that Wenck, Busse and Steiner would soon launch their multi-pronged counterattack which would crush the attacking Soviet forces. And he even went as far as to tell General Weidling, who now commanded the defense of Berlin, that these armies would soon save the city. And terrified of countering Hitler's increasingly mad delusions, General Krieg spent the day continuously ordering Wenck, Busser, and Steiner to press on with their attacks and relieve Berlin, knowing full well that they lacked the resources to do so. In any case, Busser, who had been given the authority on the 25th to decide for himself the best plan of action for his Ninth Army, played the see no evil, hear no evil card, and he refused to even acknowledge the communications coming out of the Führerbunker. However, even if Busser had wanted to keep in contact with German High Command, this was becoming increasingly difficult to do so, because today the Air Chief Marshal Novikov, commander of the Soviet Air Force, launched Operation Salute. And this operation involved massive air raids on Berlin, with nearly 1,400 aircraft launching bombing raids on the city. These air raids wreaked havoc, weakened the German defences in Berlin, and crucially, hindered the ability of German High Command to communicate with its armies on the battlefield. By now, the Halbe Pocket has shrunk to 1,200 square kilometres, with Zhukov's forces in the east of the pocket capturing between 10 to 15 kilometres every day. Attempts by the Luftwaffe to resupply the Ninth Army via the landing strip in Kyrig failed spectacularly, and on the morning of the 25th, the Ninth Army reported that the army had been abandoned by the Air Force, with no planes landing or supplies dropped at the airfield in Kyrig, despite the landing zones being clear of enemy troops and fire. Desperate pleas for supplies continued to be made, but it wasn't until 10 to 7 in the evening that an official reply came, stating that indeed a supply plane had arrived at the airfield at 3 a.m. on the morning of the 25th, but that no landing signals or runways could be seen. A further message stated that 6 more supply planes would be sent later that evening, and 75 tons were reported as being successfully delivered. However, the situation was rapidly deteriorating, and whilst further supply drops were attempted, most of the planes which were sent either couldn't land, or contact was lost with them before they could even arrive over the airfield, most likely as a result of them being shot down by flak or Red Army fighter planes. Due to the danger the supply planes were in, and the encroaching fighting on the ground which was putting the landing strip at risk, all further supply drops from the Luftwaffe were cancelled shortly after midnight on the 26th. And this condemned the Ninth Army to attempt their breakouts to the west with whatever sparse rations and ammunition they had. To compound problems further, the Soviet Air Force was making full use of the air supremacy they now enjoyed over the pocket. Firstly, Soviet reconnaissance planes could clearly see that the remainder of Ninth Army forces were starting to withdraw from the northern, eastern and southern flanks of the pocket towards Halbe in the west, in anticipation of a breakout. This meant the Soviets knew what the Germans were planning to do. Moreover, Soviet fighter planes were strafing the columns of troops and refugees at will, forcing them to scatter and take cover wherever they could. Roads soon became blocked by vehicles and tanks which had been destroyed by the bombers, and this caused long traffic jams for the escapees. And lastly, the Soviets then severely damaged the key bridges over the Dahme River in the town of Märkisch-Buchholz. This only compounded the delays for the Ninth Army troops, as many were now forced to bypass the town on foot and walk through the surrounding fields and forests instead. Adding to the overall sense of chaos in the pocket were the reports of so-called Seydlitz troops operating in the area. And from today, these reports play a central theme of many diary entries and first-hand accounts of the fighting. But who were the Seydlitz troops? The Seydlitz troops were German prisoners of war who had undergone anti-fascist training in Soviet POW camps, and these troops worked under Soviet officers in the Red Army's 7th Department. They were named Seydlitz troops after the General von Seydlitz-Kurzbach, who was a German general who surrendered at Stalingrad, and he helped form the pro-Soviet National Committee for a Free Germany, which was under NKVD control. The main reported tasks of the Seydlitz troops in the Halbe Pocket was to demoralise and confuse the German Ninth Army, and they did this by spreading propaganda and giving false orders to retreating troops, causing them to go into the wrong directions. In rare cases, there were even reports that they would set up traps for German troops and participate in Red Army attacks. Whilst first-hand reports from Ninth Army soldiers in the pocket often mention the presence of Seydlitz troops, and describe their actions, the actual usage of these troops by the Red Army, and whether they took part in any fighting against German soldiers, is disputed, particularly amongst historians. Whatever the truth, The belief in the existence of the Soviet Fifth Column exacerbated the sense of panic and confusion within the pocket, and the Seydlitz troops' stories added to the Ninth Army's logistical and organizational headaches. To give one example of how the alleged presence of Seydlitz troops impacted the course of the battle, I will share with you an account from Hauptsturmfuhrer Hohengassner, who served in the 550th SS Anti-Aircraft Division. On the 25th of April 1945, our squad was redistributed to the area of Hermsdorf Forst am Hammer. It was at the time when the enemy put the lid on the Halber cauldron. We were completely encircled. The enemy hammered us with an irresistible ferocity, deploying supporters of the National Committee for a Free Germany, who were charged to cause confusion amongst German troops. This is when we first came across Seydlitz troops and realized what their intentions were. Men in fake officers' uniforms began to appear more and more frequently, mingling amongst our troops and issuing what struck us as the most impossible orders, which they presented to us as commands from higher up. These fabricated instructions had a devastating impact. They varied in content and complemented each other. Units were not permitted to retreat. They were to gather and convene at assembly points. It was their duty to blow up guns, tanks, and other vehicles. Non-compliance with the orders would result in unit leaders being shot immediately, on the spot. One thing these turncoats had in common was that none seemed to cover their heads. They all wore a white armband and sported new uniforms on which were pinned numerous decorations. Chaos erupted close to the Dahme River. Units thrust forwards from all directions towards its only bridge. Some intended to escape to Wendisch-Buchholz, others to Halber. Amid the turmoil, members of the National Committee for a Free Germany issued conflicting orders as described above. What followed was total mayhem. Officers took their own lives, and men became hysterical, running through the open space like hounded prey. Wounded bodies piled up high on the roadside. Indiscriminate Russian fire caused heavy casualties on our side, and there was no resistance to speak of. Each one of us was his own commander. However, there was one piece of good news for the Ninth Army on the 25th of April. As the Frankfurt Oder garrison successfully evacuated the city and broke through the Soviet lines to reach the Ninth Army. This crucial injection of manpower enabled Busser to concentrate his forces, and he could now start planning his first breakout attempt. But whilst the Ninth Army started its breakout preparations, the Soviets doubled down on their preparations to contain any such breakout. Konev reinforced the flanks of his 1st Ukrainian Front by transferring the 1st Guards Artillery Division to support the 3rd Guards Army, which was now positioned directly opposite the 9th Army between Halber and Mährisch-Buchholz. The artillery division was concentrated in the Tornau-Neuendorf sector, with its heaviest guns placed directly behind the 21st Rifle Corps, which faced the town of Halber. The artillery division immediately set up an overlapping grid of fire, which could be brought down to bear on the Ninth Army in two distinct ways. Firstly, if a localized breakout attempt occurred, then the artillery division could train all of their guns onto a specific area and thus pulverize anyone escaping. And secondly, the artillery division was also able to unleash constant artillery barrages over a large-scale area as well, if needed. Special provisions were also made to enable night firing as well, as it was assumed the Ninth Army would likely try to use the cover of night to facilitate a breakout attempt. With the artillery in place, Konev ordered the 3rd Guards Army to occupy all woodland tracks and to establish strong defensive choke points along the main road directly west of Halber. The 3rd Guards Army also created simple yet effective tank traps. These traps consisted of blocking forest roads with felled trees and then placing concealed anti-tank guns to the side of the roads. These guns would then open fire on the German tanks once they got stuck. To saturate the defensive positions even further, 40,000 mines were laid and multiple barricades reinforced with explosives were made along a 12-kilometre stretch. Reserve infantry divisions and mobile tank reserves were also placed in the toy pits area, just in case the first defence line was unable to contain any initial breakthrough. Meanwhile, the 28th Army was deployed to positions east of the town of Barut, and this allowed the Soviets to have a second defence line there. Additionally, pressure was increased on the Halber pocket itself, with the 76th Rifles Corps from the 3rd Guards Army ordered to attack the pocket from the south, via the direction of Strapitz and Schlepsich. This it did in cooperation with the 33rd Army from the 1st Belarusian Front operating on its right flank. However, it took time for the Soviet defense traps to be built and for all of their units to move into their assigned positions. This meant that by the evening of the 25th, a small gap still existed in the Soviet lines between the 3rd Guards Army and the 28th Army. And this small gap would soon see the first breakout attempt from the German 9th Army. But unfortunately for the Germans, the first breakout attempt would prove to be uncoordinated, poorly planned, and poorly executed. So General Busse created two battle groups to lead the first breakout attempt, because as we all know, the Wehrmacht loves a good battle group. The first battle group, the Battlegroup von Luck, was commanded by Colonel Hans von Luck of the 21st Panzer Division, and this group consisted of von Luck's 125th Panzer Grenadier Regiment, accompanied by the remaining Panther tanks of the 22nd Panzer Regiment. Von Luck's forces had just reached Busse's lines after falling back from the Neisse River, where they had previously been attached to the 4th Panzer Army, and now they were being thrown straight into action. Busse ordered von Luck's battlegroup to attack the Soviet lines immediately to the west of Halbe and strike towards the Berlin-Dresden major road in the Luckenwalde area. Here, they were to keep the breakout point open, which would then allow the rest of the 9th Army to follow through on foot. The second battlegroup was led by SS Colonel Rüdiger Pipkorn. This group consisted of the remains of the 35th SS Police Grenadier Division and the remaining tanks of the 10th SS Panzer Division Frunzburg. Their task was to strike out westwards from the southern flank of the Halbe pocket, from the town of Schlepsich, north of Lübben. Busse's plan was for the two groups to break out simultaneously at 8 p.m. that evening, and his hope was that they could secure the vital town of Beirut and its transport hub. If this hub could be captured, this would allow the 9th Army to proceed along the roads leading west towards Jüterbog and Luckenwalde. Crucially, the orders Busse gave to the two groups explicitly forbid the transport of refugees, as Busse feared the presence of thousands of civilians would hamper the movement of the tanks and armoured vehicles. By 7 p.m, several tanks had arrived at the Battlegroup von Luck's marshalling area. Ammunition was loaded, and the fuel was distributed amongst the tanks. But as there were no transport vehicles to accompany them, the tanks could only set off with the ammunition and fuel which they were currently carrying. This severely restricted their fighting ability, and it limited the distances which they could hope to achieve. And despite Busse's orders, hundreds of desperate civilians had noticed the battlegroup was preparing to break out. They surrounded the tanks, and they pleaded and begged to go with them. Von Luck simply didn't have the heart to turn them away. His battlegroup set off at 8 p.m. as planned, aiming to reach their first objective, the town of Beirut. At first, the attack went better than anyone had hoped for, and when they reached the Berlin to Dresden major road, they found only light resistance. The group established roadblocks and pressed on. However, the breakout attempt was about to meet its first hurdle, as von Luck's group discovered the two bridges across the major road by the Teupitz-Halbe junction had been blown by the Soviets. This prevented his tanks from going down the main road to Beirut, so they were forced to go off-road and take the woodland paths instead. But despite the delays, the refugees stuck close to their tank escorts, and whenever the tanks paused, the civilians patiently waited behind them until it was time for all, tanks and civilians alike, to move again. Von Luck's group reached the outskirts of Beirut by midnight, but as they emerged from the woods, they were immediately met with heavy anti-tank fire and machine gun fire. Clearly, the Soviets had anticipated a breakout attempt passing through the town. What the Soviets had done was actually fortify the entrances to the town with heavy Joseph Stalin tanks buried into the ground, with leaving only their turrets exposed. These tanks surpassed anything the Germans had in their arsenal, and they effectively blocked any further advance for von Luck's group. Von Luck turned his battlegroup to the right and sent in his panzer grenadiers to take the town from the north, as this appeared to be the easiest alternative route. What was key here was not to get pinned down by the Soviets and give them the chance to bring in reinforcements. Speed was of the essence. But just then, some Panthers from the Battlegroup Pipkorn appeared from the east. Battlegroup Pipkorn had commenced their breakout attempt at 8 p.m, as planned, but they had soon become bogged down by the defensive positions constructed by the Red Army's 329th Rifle Division. Pipkorn's group had come under intense artillery fire, and they had suffered repeated flanking attacks. This led to their entire attack collapsing, with the lead tank scattering. Only a few small groups managed to reach the Autobahn at Starkow before crossing south of Halbe and pushing on via Dornswalde onto Beirut, where they met von Luck's group. Now the two groups had met, the flanking manoeuvre around Beirut could proceed, and troops were thus sent to seize the small village of Muckendorf to the north of Beirut. The hope was that the combined German battle groups could bypass Beirut completely and advance into the woods surrounding the floodlands of the Hammer Fleece. But once again, the flanking troops faced intense artillery fire, and they were pinned down. To give you an idea of the viciousness of the fighting, here is a quote from schoolboy Erwin Hildebrands, who lived in the village of Radeland, just east of Beirut. During the fighting, Soviet soldiers hid under the roofs, in the sheds and barns facing northeast, and many foxholes were dug along the eastern edge of the village. In addition, there are some 122mm artillery pieces also aimed towards the woods. One gun was destroyed and lay on the roadside for weeks. There were over 50 SS dead lying just inside the woods on the right-hand side of the track leading to Neuendorf. The crew of an unknown type of tank heading towards Beirut from Dornswalde were shot at the entrance to Radeland by the Soviets. Their bodies being put into the mass grave with the others mentioned above, the tank crews in their black uniforms being treated as SS. By the end of the day, the battle groups had suffered heavy losses, but von Luck still reported to Buster saying he wanted to carry on his attack throughout the night, for he feared the morning light would bring the Soviet Air Force into play, and that would spell doom for his men.